You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, top of the Tuesday morning, afternoon, evening, whatever it may be to you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Herman Cain's non-campaign continues to implode. There is evidence that Occupy Wall Street is working. Occupy Nashville just got a big boost. Republicans are doing something truly bizarre in the House of Representatives today. I mean, truly bizarre. When I tell you about this, it's just going to, you know, raise the hair on the back of your neck. Big Oil is making a fortune. I guess that's not news until you actually notice how much they're making and what the price of gas is. We'll share that with you. And the 1%, speaking of the 1%, has moved into the halls of Congress. And boy, are they doing well there. So some interesting things for our day, for our program. I think, frankly, the most interesting thing is if just looking at the front page of the Financial Times, for example, the headline at the very top, this is, you know, today's Financial Times, this is their electronic edition. I left the newspaper at home, but they typically track each other pretty closely. Fears rise of disorderly Greek default. Right. I was up around 4 o'clock this morning listening to the BBC, and they're talking about how all the markets in Europe are opening down a couple of hundred points because it looks like the Greeks are going to hold a referendum on whether they should pay back the banksters the same way as the Icelanders did. And if the people say no, then the banksters get screwed. Well, what's missed in all this coverage, what's missed in the story, is that it was the banksters who created this crisis in the first place. And the best reporter I know of on this topic is Matt Taibbi. Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone newspaper, whatever it is, weekly, and author of The Great Derangement and most recently Griftopia, RollingStone.com. And Matt, welcome back to the program.
How's it going, Tom?
Good, good. Give us the story behind the story about Greece, because I don't think most Americans have a clue. I mean, this could be like the Archduke Ferdinand moment, you know, the assassination of this obscure guy in Sarajevo in 17, kicks off World War One, and nobody to this day seems really sure why, other than all these interlocking agreements that everybody had. But let me just toss it to you, Matt.
Well, it's a fairly complicated story, but essentially, way back in, I think it was 2001 or 2002, Greece was facing a debt crisis, in order to retain its membership in the EU. I believe the situation was that their government couldn't exceed a certain number. It was something like 60%. Of their GDP or something like that.
Right.
And so they were in danger of exceeding the EU prescribed debt limit, and they needed to get around that problem. So what they did is they went to
If I may interrupt, the reason that was a big issue was because if they got kicked out of the EU, they couldn't use the euro, they wouldn't have access
right.
to all the, you know, all the resources of the rest of the European Union, they couldn't sell it and buy it, no tariffs, those kinds of things.
Exactly. And, you know, again, this all will end up tying into all the problems that Europe is experiencing now, trying to hold the euro together, trying to hold the EU together
right.
economically and so on. So Greece is, you know, sort of this economically a rogue state. It was exceeding its debt limit. And so what do you do when you have that situation? If you're a sovereign entity like a country, you can go to the investment banks. And what they did is they arranged with Goldman, they bought a series of what are called cross-currency swaps. It's essentially an interest rate swap or a currency swap. And all it really did is it's a derivative instrument that allowed Greece to push more of its debt into the future as opposed to having to pay it up front. Now, there are some people who would contend that what Greece did by essentially reworking its balance sheet to make it look like it didn't have to pay off that much debt that year. That didn't actually change its debt situation. It was still over its debt limit. It had just rearranged the deck chairs a little bit to look like it had less of a.
Well, not only that, it made it worse because now they had fees that they had to pay to Goldman.
Right, exactly. And that sounds bad enough, but what's so incredible about this story is that after Goldman set up, sold Greece all of these swaps, and incidentally, this is something, we'll get into this too, this is something that goes on not just in Greece, but in countries all over the world and localities here in the United States, places like Jefferson County, Alabama, these swaps are everywhere. As soon as they did this, what did they do? They went up and they set up an exchange so that you could, they and other investment banks could short, bet against Greek debt. So they worsened Greece's debt situation and then turned right around and bet against them. So all of this kind of leads directly to the situation that we're in now because these situations, all it really does is you take a present group of politicians who have a financial problem and they just hire the investment banks to kick the problem to a future set of politicians, and that's what's happening now. The 2002 politicians created the mess that we're in now.
Right, and Papandreou, who's the current prime minister of Greece, was he in on this back in 2002?
You know, I don't know that, actually. I mean, the only reason I really know that much about this particular story is because I had to do a story about Alabama and where other investment banks sold very similar instruments to Jefferson County in the Birmingham area. So I was sort of looking at it parenthetically, and I don't know that.
So it was basically the same scam, and these Wall Street banksters who basically set up and now are bringing down Greece, are absent from the news. They're just absent from the news reports. Just like they're absent from the news reports when states talk about how their pension funds are broke. Nobody ever mentions the fact that their pension funds are broke because they were invested in CDOs and derivatives that were sold to them by these Wall Street banks. I don't get it. How do they get away with this invisibility?
I don't know that. I think people don't understand how these things work. In the case of the mortgage-backed securities, this is just outright a theft. I mean, what these guys are doing on Wall Street, they would lend money to a company like Countrywide or New Century that would create a huge mass of really, really dicey subprime loans. And then they would take those loans, chop them up, turn them into AAA-rated securities using some hocus-pocus math, and then they would turn around and look for suckers who manage state pension funds, and they would take these guys to the Super Bowl and to strip clubs and get them to spend $1 billion of taxpayer money buying this stuff. And then when it all blows up, suddenly it's the state is broken, it can't pay its pension funds because we're paying too much in salary to teachers and firemen or whatever it is. And somehow they forget this other story that went on that actually caused the problem.
Right. Yeah, it really is quite extraordinary, and you've done a brilliant job of reporting about it, particularly here in the United States, as you said, with Jefferson County and much of the other work that you've done, and in Griftopia as well. Matt Taibbi, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Matt, just 30 seconds. What's your quick thoughts on what's going to happen in Greece?
You know, I don't know. I talked to somebody just yesterday about this, and most people think that they're going to figure out some kind of controlled crash landing situation. But the problem is there's not a whole lot they can do. The rent is going to come due sooner rather than later. So it's whether you're going to take your pain or now or later. It's
or default.
Really
or default.
Right. Exactly.
I'd frankly bet on the default, but we'll see. We'll see. Matt Taibbi with RollingStone.com. Rolling Stone. Matt, thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Great talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So could this be the beginning of the end for the United States, for Europe, for the banksters? Probably not for the banksters. They'll do it just fine.
But the thrill we never know is the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Our homage to Matt Taibbi. He's done some just absolutely great reporting over there at Rolling Stone. Anyhow, I started out by saying here are the headlines on today's Financial Times, and I want to just give you a snapshot of what's going on in the world today as a consequence of what these banksters have done. And I think that this really frames the 99% patriot movement. I'm starting, you know, I have noticed that the corporate media, the mainstream media, is constantly referring to these people as protesters. And whenever the Tea Party was out there, they were always referred to as patriots. I think these people are as patriotic as any Tea Partier. They want their country to work. They want to take their country back from the banksters. That's a patriotic thing. But in any case, here are the headlines. Fears rise of disorderly Greek default. This is the concern now that the Prime Minister Papandreou has said, okay, you know, we're supposed to pay all this money back to these banksters. And by the way, they're French banksters and German banksters and a whole bunch of banksters. We're supposed to pay all this money back. Let's take a vote on whether we pay it back. Now, in Iceland, they took two votes. The first one, 98% of the people said no, don't give them a penny. The second time they took the vote, as I recall, it dropped down into the 70s. This was after an aggressive lobbying campaign, not just by the banks, but by the government, to say, we really should pay our debts. No, said the Icelanders. And I'm betting that the Greeks are going to say no, too. And there's a lot of politicians in Greece right now who are pretty horrified by the fact that Papandreou said, hey, let's ask the people if we should pay the banksters. I mean, look in the United States how we have changed our bankruptcy laws over the years to make them super bankster friendly and super screw the average guy friendly or hostile. Can you imagine if that legislation, instead of being written by legislators, 50 of whom are multimillionaires. I mean, you know, it's really quite astounding. The net worth of members of Congress has increased a whopping 25% in the past year. I don't know what your net worth has gone up, but it's unlikely, unless you're part of the top 1%, that it was anything close to 25%. Most people's net worth actually went down last year. But the net worth of the average member of Congress went up 25%, but you've got a wealth gap there. 95% of that new wealth went to just 50 members of Congress, all the multimillionaires. 219 members of Congress are now millionaires. That's 40% of Congress. The richest is a guy from Texas by the name of Michael McCaul, who, oddly enough, is a Republican. He's worth $294 million, which puts Daryl Issa, the former richest man in Congress, and the only former criminal in Congress, into the number two position. I guess Issa needs to, you know, build another road or highway exit near one of his office buildings in California in order to jack his net worth back up. But anyhow, here's the headlines. From the Financial Times, fears rise of disorderly Greek default. Stocks slide as Eurozone woes return to haunt investors. The U.S., the New York Stock Exchange right now is down 222 points. We'll see where that goes. But MF Global's demise felt by Commodities Exchange. This was a bankruptcy, you know, a brokerage bankruptcy. CME admits oversight lapse on MF Global and U.S. manufacturing. Here's a couple of the really interesting ones. U.S. manufacturing growth slows in October. Global turmoil hits demand. These are the signs of not just a recession, but a depression, frankly. U.S. consumer spending rise outpaces income. In other words, the average consumer in the United States is once again going into debt more rapidly than they're getting wealthy. U.S. economic recovery in the balance. U.S. retailers target seasonal shoppers. Christmas is coming. People are going to get more in debt. That's the bottom line there. And then after that, where do we go? And then this, I thought, was particularly interesting. China PMI falls unexpectedly in October. The manufacturing index in China, in other words, China is starting to slow down. Now, China is the factory floor to the world. If they're starting to slow down, the rest of the world isn't buying. And then, of course, drug companies, Pfizer profits surge on international demand. But Italian bond yields, the Italians are in the same problem the Greeks are. And they got in bed with the banksters. They got badly in debt. They're paying over 6% on their bonds right now, which means that they're paying so much to borrow money in the interest that they can hardly afford the interest. Like, you know, the VIG is going to get them. So here we have this bankster disaster brought to you courtesy of a number of banks, but probably at the lead, Goldman Sachs and Lloyd Blankfein. And in fact, Matt Taibbi's piece in the Rolling Stone was titled "The People versus Goldman Sachs." A Senate committee has laid out the evidence. Now the Justice Department should bring criminal charges. That's the subhead in the Rolling Stone article by Matt Taibbi. So we're seeing the consequences. You know, we made this decision during the Reagan years, when 34% of our economy was manufacturing, to move away from manufacturing and move to an economy based on finance, on making money with money. At that time, finance was about 10% of our economy, manufacturing about 34%. Now, finance is about 35% of our economy, manufacturing is about 11%. They pretty much reversed positions. Has it worked out well for the rest of us? I don't think so.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's done really well for the banksters, though. Back with your thoughts on this. And Big Oil's Scary Haul right after this.
Just when I thought the big deal was done. Oh, nothing wrong had just begun. One thing I do know, when you get a good taste, everything else just goes to waste.
Okay, I mentioned that the Occupy Wall Street movement is working. SunTrust Bank has said, you know that $5 debit card fee? People who use debit cards tend to be in the lower three-fifths of Americans. We're going to pass on that. And Regions Bank came out with the same thing. Dick Durbin is writing letters to the banks demanding that they disclose how much money they're making off the fees. Occupy Nashville Patriots got a boost from the courts yesterday. This is a good one. It'll be very interesting to see if this goes national, because basically what this judge has said is that your right, your First Amendment right to peaceably assemble and petition your government for redress of grievances, your First Amendment right trumps local zoning laws. Because what had happened in Nashville is basically the Nashville Patriots were going to be evicted from a public park because Nashville had gotten together the city and passed an ordinance, a law, a zoning requirement, whatever it may be, saying basically you can't be there after certain hours or in certain ways. And the judge said, no, sorry, this is political. This is a petitioning of for redress of grievances. This is what patriots do. These are political acts, and political acts are the most protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and therefore the city may not prevent people from engaging in acts of political petitioning the government for redress of grievance, for life, you know, to use the language, the actual literal language of the First Amendment. So let's hope other courts follow suit. I mean, this is not the kind of decision, frankly, I think that this Supreme Court would do. But, you know, who knows? Anyhow, and the Republicans in the House of Representatives, the Republicans control the House, but not the Senate, as you know. And which is why Daryl Issa, for example, who runs the House Oversight Committee, the only criminal in the House of Representatives, at least to the best of my knowledge, the only former criminal, is all about let's look into the Obama administration, let's look into Solander. You know, he's trying to do what they did to Clinton. You know, let's investigate him to death, and maybe we'll find something eventually. And they found something pretty weak, frankly, on Clinton. But, you know, he made the mistake of trying to lie his way out of it. But nonetheless, they're continuing to do that. But they're also continuing to ignore the job crisis. They have held control of the House of Representatives for about a year now. And they have not passed one single piece of jobs legislation. Last week, it was an anti-abortion bill that they passed. The week before that, it was legislation taking away funding for National Public Radio. Now, none of this stuff is going to become law. It's not going to make it through the Senate. It won't be signed by the president. These are just the Republicans engaging in... There's a phrase for it I'm not sure I can use on the radio, but basically they're just, you know, they're playing with themselves. I mean, they're just, and now this is going to be the big piece of legislation in the House of Representatives this week. It's going to be voted on today. Whether or not to make the official motto of the United States, "In God We Trust." Now, first of all, it's been on our coin since the 1950s. I mean, there's nobody, zero. Not one member of Congress who has suggested that we remove it from our coins or anything else. And whether it's the motto or not the motto, it doesn't create a single job. But you got this congressman from Virginia, Randy Forbes, who says, "Passing this legislation sends a message that In God We Trust is not only written in the halls of our federal buildings," which actually created probably some jobs, people carving it into the stone, but that's already been done. "Not only written in the halls of our federal buildings, but it is the bedrock upon which our nation is built." Hey, how about passing part of the president's jobs bill? He's willing to break it into 100 pieces. You could pick one and pass it. They want to name airports after Reagan or make In God We Trust the official national motto. I'm telling you, the Republican strategy for 2012 is crash the economy. And in the meantime, the president is doing by executive order things that the Republicans are just refusing to do. Meanwhile, Exxon, Shell, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil, and Chevron, the five big oil companies, we no longer have competition in any industry in the United States. We have these oligarchies, basically, these kleptocracies. And these five big oil companies, so far they've made over $1,000 million. They've made $1 million over 1,000 times. Excuse me, over 100,000 times. That's $100 billion. Now, you recall ExxonMobil was the most profitable company in the world last year. They paid no federal income taxes and haven't for years and years. They're all getting corporate welfare to the tune of tens of millions of dollars from the U.S. taxpayer. And they're on pace to make $140 billion in profit this year. You would think that if they're that massively profitable and being subsidized by we, the taxpayers, that they might drop the price of gasoline. Nah, not going to do that. After all, they can make more money by raising the price. This is what happens when you get monopolies. This is why, you know, it's like when Jimmy Carter broke up AT&T, and it was actually initiated by Jerry Ford. This was back in the day when politicians of both parties realized that competition was a good thing. And they broke up AT&T into seven companies and spun off Bell Labs as Lucian Technologies. And what happened? You had an explosion of innovation, competition, and lower prices in the telecommunications industry. Then Reagan came into office and said, "We're not going to enforce the Sherman Act anymore." And suddenly had all these mergers and acquisition mania people pulling all these companies back together, and now, as I said, you know, Exxon and Mobil merged, and now you got this giant oil company. It's just a mess. So this is the state of America, and the Republicans like this very much, thank you. And frankly, I think it's time for us to say, and this is what's happening in the Occupy movement, is to say, you know, we are patriotic Americans, the other 99%, and we're not going to take this anymore. We would like to see some significant changes. Bobby in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on AM 1480. Bobby, what's up?
Well, I know you can clarify this for me because you are absolutely brilliant and you have amazing recall and you're on top of things. Didn't both houses and the president sign that trade bill? And that doesn't that hurt some American jobs? Or am I completely wrong?
Yeah, you're talking about the Colombia, Panama, South Korea free trade bill that President Obama has been pushing?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if he signed it yet. It would surprise me if he hasn't. I think, in fact, actually, I seem to recall that there was a ceremony last week where he signed it. He certainly got it passed through Congress, and this was he said part of his jobs bill. So arguably, if he's calling this his jobs bill, that was the one piece that the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House of Representatives, agreed with and passed. And
well, doesn't it hurt American workers to some extent?
Yes, it will. Let's just break the pieces down. But there's a fourth piece to it. There's three pieces. First of all, with regard to Colombia, what we're doing is we're basically supporting the corporations there that literally hire people to kill union workers. That makes me cringe. With regard to Panama, they don't pretty much export anything. What it does is it gives very rich Americans access to the most secretive banking system in the Western Hemisphere, so they no longer have to go to Liechtenstein or Switzerland to hide their money from the government. And with regard to South Korea, it actually may create some American jobs if the South Koreans hold to it, because it requires them. They've been operating in a very, very closed marketplace since 1965. I think it was either 61 or 65 when General Park staged his military coup and took over South Korea and turned it into a first world nation, basically. But they've been operating the way that we used to operate prior to the 1980s as a protected economy. And if this opens the economy of South Korea up, it may create some American jobs. But, you know, net, the fourth piece of the legislation that nobody wants to talk about is that there's funding in the legislation to train Americans who have lost their jobs because of this free trade agreement so that they can get new jobs. And we've seen that movie before, and that training doesn't tend to go anywhere, and those jobs tend to be nothing jobs. So, yeah.
Have you heard about what's going on in South Dakota? I think it's South Dakota with the oil. They discovered $24 billion or more, and there's something like 18,000 jobs, and they're just basically praying for people. They did this on Brian Williams' show last night, and they said 18,000 jobs waiting. Every day a job and a half opens up if you want to work and you want to move. And probably lives not too comfortably for a little while. But there's a tremendous boom going on there. And I think that's great. And it's odd that it just suddenly appeared.
Yeah, it's not just, you're talking about North Dakota, not South Dakota, right?
Is it North? Yes, okay.
Yeah, and this is the state that has its own bank. Actually, it might be South Dakota. I mix up the Dakotas. But this is the state that has its own bank. And so it funds things itself. And it has never had a massive unemployment problem. You're right. And whether, you know, the extent to which they've discovered oil there versus coal, tar, and whatnot, I don't frankly know. But Bobby, thanks. I'll look into it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, and Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, Washington, our Occupy Seattle reporter, and Jamie Dimon reporter. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, it looks like we're going to have an interesting day tomorrow, because the number one target for a lot of people's frustration about the bailouts in the banks is coming to town tomorrow. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon will be at the Sheraton Hotel tomorrow sometime between 6 and 7 o'clock. So people are planning to march over there from Westlake Center, meeting at Westlake Park at 6 p.m.
Now, this is the guy who gave $4.6 million as a gift to the New York Police Department's fund for their families and for parties and things. And then the New York Police Department turned rather hostile toward the protesters in New York. Is he bringing gifts to the Seattle Police Department?
I think actually he's here to speak to students from the University of Washington's business school. So one of my questions would be, how much did they pay this guy to fly out here and speak to these students? And what I'm hearing is that there's some unrest at the University of Washington as a result of this, and there are students that are organized there.
I would think even in the business school, even among people who want to be business people when they grow up, and I never, in my young years, I never thought of myself as, gee, I want to be a businessman when I grow up. But I've ended up owning my own businesses for the last 35 years, and so I guess I am. But even among people who are into business, there's a large percentage of them, and I meet them all the time, who are good, ethical, appropriate people, you know, who want to run a business right rather than hustlers and banksters like, frankly, in my personal opinion, Jamie Dimon and these other CEOs on Wall Street of these anti-competitive monopolists, monopoly banks or duopoly or whatever you call them, opolies, are. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, it causes one to wonder, what is the title of his presentation? Is it How to Bankrupt a Multi-Billion Dollar Corporation and Still Get Bailed Out by the U.S. Taxpayer?
And still take home tens of millions of dollars, personally.
Yeah.
That might be it. How to Get a Golden Parachute. How to, very interesting. Okay, Mark, thanks a lot for the report. I got to move along. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, yeah, good talking to you. Robert in Baltimore. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm trying to figure out a way to how to get the Occupy movement to focus attention on the Citizens United decision. And I'm thinking, how about if we turn it into a transnational corporation and see if we can enhance their free speech rights?
But that basically just gives you the right to buy media, which means you have to have money. The good news is that many of the Occupy movements, like as we just saw in Nashville, are being recognized by the courts as citizens exercising their First Amendment right to petition the government for redress of grievances, to peaceably assemble to do the same. And you know, that's a good thing. I think that, your point, although I'm assuming tongue in cheek, is well taken. I think just standing firm and standing tall, though, is the way to go. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's up?
Hey, I'm just curious. What is free market capitalism? Because
it's an oxymoron.
An argument.
Huh? It's an oxymoron.
Okay.
Capitalism is a form of an economic system whereby people make money with money. In other words, a capitalist is a person who doesn't work for a living. They take their capital, their money, they loan it to other people or invest it with other people and put it at risk and make a return on that, presumably. And, you know, that's capitalism. So capitalism allows for basically remote ownership as opposed to cooperative systems where the people who own the business are actually also the people who work in the business. That's not capitalism. And
no, because the argument they were making was they were saying that the free market capitalism is what made America great. Can we go back to that system?
Right.
That's what they were saying.
Well, you could argue that capitalism speeds up the rate at which businesses will grow. It also, however, if it's unrestrained, speeds up the rate at which they will grow into giant monopolies and anti-competitive monopolies and strangle marketplaces and then destroy the very, you know, they become cancerous and they destroy their host. And that's what's happening right now. And the guys who attach the word free market to the word capitalism, the actual phrase is laissez-faire capitalism, which means basically no rules capitalism or very few rules or unregulated capitalism. And
we're in this bind already.
That's exactly why we're in this bind, because we abandoned regulated capitalism, which we had, you know, through basically from the Teddy Roosevelt administration, and particularly since the Franklin Roosevelt administration, up until Reagan came in and stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. And then we got unregulated capitalism, and that unregulated capitalism led to enormous profits for the capitalists, for the owners of capital, for the owners, for the people, for the top 1%, for the very wealthy few. They've seen their income since Ronald Reagan came into office go up 257%, right. Whereas the rest of us have seen income increases anywhere from, you know, a minus 30% to a top to a plus 16%, depending on which quintile you're in. And it, and that's the cancer stage of capitalism. And it's a consequence of the Reagan tax cuts, Reagan deregulation, and Reagan no longer enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and no president since then doing so. And then when you top that off with doing away with the protections, the membrane that we had around this country called an international trade policy, you puncture that or tear it down and say to the corporations that used to be just American corporations, now you can go transnational. Now you can, you know, it can exploit labor anywhere in the world and put that worker in China or Vietnam who's willing to work for $3 a day in competition with the guy working in a factory in Flint, Michigan, then you have a prescription for absolute disaster for our country. And that's what's happened. Walter, thank you for the call. There's no such thing as free market capitalism. Free markets is like saying a football game with no rules. Jesse LaGreca is next from Occupy Wall Street, New York.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. In our first hour, we spent some time talking about Greece and how the world is melting down economically as the result of Goldman Sachs. Matt Taibbi was on laying out how basically Goldman Sachs set up Greece and then took them down. And Papandreou, the prime minister, has now said, let's have a referendum like the Icelanders did. Let's decide whether or not we're going to pay back. And the people of Greece are, you know, pretty broadly saying, nah, don't think so. So, you know, what's the deal with that? We'll see. Everybody's looking at that. And meanwhile, Jesse LaGreca is on the line with Occupy Wall Street in New York City. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing, brother?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. I just got back to New York yesterday night, and I'm here at Zuccotti Park for the first time in about a week and a half, and I'm stunned. It is beautiful. It's transformed in the last week and a half, and I'm really encouraged by the amount of compassion and hard work people are willing to put in for their future. You know, it's something that we should all be proud of.
That's great. By the way, your website, Jesse LaGreca, LaGreca.com, and Occupy Wall Street. You can find a million different ways. Occupy Wall Street. Whatever it is, org, I think. But a New York Police Department spokesman told Salon that they are not sending homeless people and drunks down to Zuccotti Park. On the other hand, we're getting reports, you know, anecdotally, reports in the field of police officers walking up to alcoholics and schizophrenics saying, hey, you want some free food? Go down to Zuccotti Park. And on the third hand, you know, if it really is a people's movement, the alcoholics and psychotics among us are part of the people. So, you know, what's the story with all this?
You know, it's really difficult because I believe it is all of our responsibility to feed the hungry. At the same time, we do not have the resources here to care for people the way they really should be cared for. I mean, they've fallen through the cracks in the social safety network, and those cracks are now being rent open so that it can be even worse. So as much as I think we should try to do our best to feed and care for everybody, the real care that they need in the homeless community, it is available other places. So I think our job is to help facilitate them to get the care from the sources that are most capable of tending to them. It's a very fine balance. What really frustrates me is the people who could care less about the homeless are the ones that want to bring this issue up. And I think they're doing it to exploit the terrible situation in society the homeless are in, because they really are the original occupiers. And I think it's our duty to help them as much as we can, but we need to understand that there are better resources for them to utilize other than the Wall Street kitchen. So it's a very fine balance to try to find the right thing to do, but we're trying our best to do the right thing.
Louise was just pointing out to me that 1 in 6 humans on Earth right now is a squatter, that the women's movement in Germany was a squatter movement, that the bonus army in the 1930s and 1932 that led right to the Franklin Roosevelt Revolution, to his election in the revolution, was a squatter movement, you know, from the lawn of the White House down to the Potomac River, 45,000 people. That, you know, squatter movements have actually a long and noble history, as part of political protest and not to mention survival. You know, most favelas, most slums around the world are actually squatters. What's the legal status of Zuccotti Park right now, and where is this going? And how are the and I remember last week there was the news about how the police came in and took away the generators just as the snowstorm was arriving. What's the status of the ability to survive the winter?
You know what? I keep telling people that if 30,000 penguins in Antarctica can get through the winter, I'm sure some intelligent people in 2011 can figure it out. I actually just passed by a bicycle generator here at Occupy Wall Street. I saw one of them up in Occupy Boston as well. And that's just one way that ingenuity will overcome all the adversity being thrown our way. At the same time, you know what? Today we have a tent city now. I didn't see this when we first came back, and I'm encouraged by it. I think that the people who are putting roadblocks in front of us want this to go away. They don't want us to have an honest conversation in the future. They don't want us to have an honest conversation about the financial bribery of our elected officials or even the lawlessness that's taking place in the private sector. So, you know what, if they're going to try to take our generators away, we'll figure out one way or another to get around this because we're in this for the long haul.
Yeah, well, just like, you know, Herbert Hoover didn't want to have a discussion of 45,000 people camped on the White House lawn all the way down to the Potomac. I'm curious, Jesse, we just got this tweet from Occupy Oakland. This is just a few hours ago. The Occupy Oakland General Assembly has passed a proposal to encourage the occupation of bank-owned/foreclosed and abandoned properties across Oakland. Now, this seems like a reasonable strategy for the winter. B, there have been movements in various places. Detroit's probably the most well known for it, where people have you know just occupied deserted properties and turned them into places that can be like little local community centers kind of things. Any talk about doing that in New York?
You know, I just got here on the ground. I love Occupy Oakland, by the way. I was just there the other day, and I'm really encouraged by the solidarity that I've seen there, especially considering the police violence. Let's look at it like this. A lot of these homes that were foreclosed on fraudulently. The banks literally cannot prove who owns the mortgage because they were spliced and diced up with credit default swaps and other financial vehicles. So you know what? If it means that we need to take back that which was taken away from us illegally or inequitously, then I'm for that. And really, consider this. You know, if people were not lied to, if people were not taken advantage of with the foreclosure scandal, then those homes would be occupied by paying tenants. Now, if those paying tenants were kicked out into the street, then yes, they should go take their homes back because that's really what we're talking about. You know, it's not about taking our country back. The country was ours already. This is about taking our future back. And if that means taking our homes back one at a time, maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it's probably something that would work better in Oakland, which is largely residential, than in New York, which is so urban that the slicing and dicing of those mortgages might have been in individual condos or something like that. But, you know, most people in Manhattan, I think, probably are renting. And so there may not be as much, at least on Manhattan Island.
Tom.
Go ahead.
I just saw something in the New York Post recently, maybe a month or so ago, that said that 92% of New York City residents who have had their homes foreclosed on, the financial institutions foreclosing on those homes, couldn't prove that they actually held the mortgage.
Right.
So you know what? That it's not just Oakland. It's New York. It's all over America. The foreclosure scandal, the forged signatures, it's fraud.
Yeah.
And
I'm absolutely with you. I'm just
so
saying.
I think it's more of a national thing than just Oakland or one place.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I'm just thinking in terms of logistics.
Okay.
Zuccotti Park is in Manhattan. I'll bet that probably 80% of that 92% that was phony foreclosures in New York was in the boroughs. You know, was in the Bronx and Brooklyn.
Sounds accurate.
Yeah, because you know they tend to be single family homes or duplexes or you know that kind of thing, rather than the kind of housing that you find in Manhattan. So Occupy Wall Street is doing well. Have you seen evidence that the NYPD is sending, you know, alcoholics, drunks, schizophrenics down to you guys?
Well, I've heard stories about there being more than there had been in the past, so
right.
I think that might be a bit of its own evidence. I also think that if that's how they're using their resources, that's deplorable. And, you know, I've had a really hard time describing my experience with NYPD because a couple of my good friends from childhood are current NYPD officers now. So it's frustrating for me. I don't want to lay the blame at their feet.
Sure.
But after the incidents that have taken place in other cities, such as Oakland and Denver, you know, I'm going to start telling the truth a little bit more honestly, because I've been trying to protect those honest people in the police community.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the police have to answer to the civil authorities. And so I would say, you know, in Oakland and Denver, talk to the mayor. You know, talk to the city council. If the police are misbehaving, they have to respond to the civilian authority. Now, obviously, there's always going to be a few rogue cops. You know, any situation where people are given power and authority. In the few seconds we have left, Jesse LaGreca, what is the message you'd like our listeners to know about?
The message I'd like your listeners to know about is the message of economic justice and social justice. And I think it starts with the total lack of accountability for the wealthy people in power, the wealthy people in political power. The larger message I'd like to spend is that this is your occupation, too. This is your protest, too, even if you're not personally involved. We're fighting for your pensions. We're fighting for better pay. We're fighting for your retirement and for your education. And
there you
I
go.
Think that
there you go. You got it.
Corporate personhood,
hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, finish your sentence, Jesse, real quick.
Just long and short, I just want to tell everybody who's listening, this is your protest as well, whether you're participating or not.
Got it. Jesse, thank you very much. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we just heard from Jesse in Occupy New York. Let's go to the other side of the country. Alan Brill, a participant in Occupy Oakland, OccupyOakland.org is the website, calling for a national strike tomorrow. Alan, welcome back. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here and be able to be talking to other occupiers around the country.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, if we can't provide a forum for that, then what good are we? The general strike for tomorrow that the I wanted to talk about that, and also the fact that I just got this tweet from Occupy Oakland, at Occupy Oakland, that says that the General Assembly has passed a proposal to encourage the occupation of bank-owned, foreclosed, and abandoned properties across Oakland. But first, the general strike. Any thoughts on how that's going to happen?
Well, we're very excited about it because this is something that has generated in only a week. The momentum is building tremendously, and the participation from many, many unions, but not just unions, community groups, people who are working on floor closure issues, people who school teachers. We have a curriculum here that we've been using. We've got like 8 different curriculums that teachers are going to be teaching around the Bay Area, stressing the kinds of income inequality issues, the general strike of 1946, and a lot of other issues. And then we're asking the students to come out on a field trip, either from school or after school. And the same with workers. People are going to be coming out at various times during the day. Some are doing full-fledged strikes. Some are just doing sick-outs. Some are just taking the days off. The city attorney here in Oakland has agreed not to punish any city worker who wants to join, because our city of Oakland has been under tremendous pressure, and we need to have this rebalance of our economy and our wealth in this country.
Yeah, it seems like a good plan. I mean, my real simplistic mantra on that is roll back the Reagan tax cuts. You know, take us back to a system that used to work. But in any case, yeah, very straightforward. The Occupy Oakland, first of all, how are things going there?
Well, we are amazed at the turnout. We can't handle the number of calls coming in from people all over the country wondering how they can participate, how they can be of support. We recognize that a general strike is a goal, that general strike is not going to happen tomorrow, but the theme is there, and we even have a proposal now to do a 3-stage strikes happening through the next 9 months here in Oakland, and maybe it'll build throughout the country, because we really believe that there needs to be militant action throughout the country, and those of us that have been active in social change issues and wanting some kind of inequality and fighting for the middle class, the working class, really feel like this is the biggest breakthrough we've seen in our lives, it's very exciting, and it's amazing that this is led by primarily people under 40. This isn't the old crowd from the anti-Vietnam War days. These are kids who are trying to say, I want a future. I don't like that my parents have been just turned out of their home. I don't like that I can't afford an education. I don't like that I got out of college maybe and can't find a job. This is the movement that we've been waiting for, to really change the priorities, go after the 1%. We know the wealth is out there. The question is, who's taking it and how can we get it back? The whole idea of the 1% controlling, you know, 40 to 50% of the wealth in this country.
Well, since Reagan put into place his tax cuts, the top 1% have seen their wealth rise by 257%, and average working Americans are basically flatlined. I mean, pretty much everybody else.
It's been a flatline for over 30 years, hasn't it?
That's what I'm talking about, since Reagan came into office.
Right. And so what we're saying, our call, and we're going to be gathering people for major dispersals throughout the city at 9, noon, and 5. And we're not targeting small businesses. We support small businesses. Small businesses are part of the 1%.
Yep.
The city of Oakland is not the enemy in this either. The enemy and the one that we need to go after and to really aggressively make some change happen here is the wealthy. And so we're pushing for the building of this worldwide solidarity movement. We want an end to police brutality and attacks. And we want the schools, libraries, social programs, after-school programs, elderly programs, which have to be cut in this city. We want them reinstated here and across the country. And we want an economic system built on equality and not corporate power. And that's what we intend to do. So we're going after the banks, the major corporations. We're asking that 1% to shut down tomorrow. And if they don't, we'll be there. And we'll be there in force, because we expect thousands and thousands of people to be in the streets tomorrow. And we're very excited about it. The Labor Council is supporting this event. Too many unions to mention to you right now, Tom. But the Labor Council is going to be feeding thousands of people right in front of City Hall tomorrow at 7 o'clock. It's just an amazing outpouring from all sectors of our community.
Hmm. Yeah. It's an extraordinary thing, and it's not just happening, of course, in Oakland, California. But you guys suffered the major blow with the police violence. How is Scott Olson, by the way?
My understanding is he's been switched to a different hospital, and that he was taken off the critical list a couple days ago. We're really pulling for Scott, but it's not just Scott. There are other people that were injured. I think that Citizen Police Review Board investigation of those police officers who are over the top, and we do have those on the Oakland Police Force. We're hoping that they'll be brought to justice, and they will not be police officers anymore. We're reinstated our camp after that at City Hall. It's been much more cooperative.
That's
and,
great. Alan, I'm sorry.
We're really rolling.
Yeah, we're out of time, but thank you. OccupyOakland.org. Thank you, Alan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So that's what Occupy Oakland's up to. That's what Occupy New York, Occupy Wall Street is up to. And I'll give you a quick summary of some of the others, and then we'll pick up your calls right after this. Okay, Occupy Nashville got a boost from the courts yesterday. The court struck down a law forbidding Occupy Nashville from setting up camp in a public park. The First Amendment does say the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances shall not be abridged. Actually, it starts off by saying Congress will pass no laws, and you know, but I'm paraphrasing, but 99% or 90% language right from there. And so, you know, these are American patriots all around the country. And there's some evidence that the Occupy Wall Street movement is working. You're seeing banks around the country saying, you know, that 5% or that $5 fee we're going to put on anybody who uses debit cards, which are typically people in the bottom 3/5 of America, use the debit cards as opposed to credit cards. They don't want to run up big balances on their credit cards. It's basically a checking account card. It's, you know, it's kind of cycling cash through. It's a way of avoiding paying high interest rates. And, you know, the wealthier people will use the credit cards to get the miles for the frequent flyer or whatever, but they pay the balance off fully every month, so they never pay a fee, right? That's how you game that system. So anyhow, the average person using a debit card, let's just start charging $5 a month. We need some more money. You know, our CEOs are only making $20, $30 million a year. I saw a sign. In fact, it's in the printer out here. I just printed it. Somebody at one of the Occupy movements is holding up a sign that said, at the minimum wage, $16,000 a year. Goldman Sachs CEO, $16,000 an hour. I think that kind of says it all. Dan in Santa Barbara. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
It's been a long time. I've been listening a long time, and this is my first time I've called.
Well, thank you for calling, Dan.
I'm going to pick up where the caller before Occupy Oakland, he was speaking about how just sneaking homeless people in to get free meals and stuff. You being a historian, you probably remember a guy from the 80s named Mitch Snyder.
Mitch Snyder. Yeah, the name is really familiar. I don't remember why, though.
Well, he had a thing called the homeless movement, and we had 250,000 people on the plaza in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Housing Now movement. He was also right. The head of the CNV, which is the Center for...
Yeah, I remember now. Yeah.
So when it comes to homeless people, we were like 25 years ahead of the curve at least.
Yeah.
And we've been occupying space ever since.
Yep.
So I think it's kind of tongue in cheek, but really homeless people were screaming about economic injustice and have been ever since. And I'm homeless, and I live in one of the swankiest places in the United States, Santa Barbara, California, and there's lots of homeless people there.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, they like to blame it on the nice weather, but I have a brother who lives in Minneapolis, and there's people that live down by the river in Minneapolis.
There's homeless people everywhere in the country. It's absolutely true. And Dan, the thing that I think that we need to differentiate is that there are some people who are homeless because they just plain old flat out are the victims of disaster. And that's probably the most rapidly growing portion of homeless in the United States. And increasingly that is families and single women and children. And then there's the second group of people who are homeless who are kind of, shall we say, campers. That's a very small fragment, but that's the one that the right wing likes to focus on.
Raise an issue here.
And then there's the third faction of the homeless, which is the schizophrenics, the mentally ill. And those are the people who, you know, before Reagan became president, by and large, were provided with medical services. Reagan closed all the mental hospitals in the country stopped all federal funding to it. And suddenly we had an explosion of schizophrenic homeless people and alcoholic homeless people. And those are the people who need help and treatment. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We were way ahead of the curve.
If you're not going to pay me a man's wage, I'm not going to do a man's job. And then you want a king's ransom for a place to live?
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
And keep my dignity and be homeless.
Yeah, there you go. Dan, I got to move along, but you said it very well. Thank you very much for doing so. Also, your phone was just breaking up really, really terribly. I'm sorry. Ed in Redondo Beach, also listening on KTLK. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Just a really quick observation. The Occupy movement is getting pretty sophisticated. I got a robocall this morning that identified itself as being from Occupy Wall Street. They urged me to call the White House, tell the president that I supported the 99% movement and that I wanted to see the Wall Street bankers put in jail.
Wow.
And the message was, you know, was very clearly the message. So I have no reason to doubt it was actually from somebody in the movement. But apparently they've got the technology. And
there was no go to this website and you discover that it's a phishing website or there's no gotcha.
It was just a flat out call to the White House message. So
that's great.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, they got the tools.
Well, and that's a brilliant message too. Ed, thank you very much for sharing that. More of us need to be calling the White House and saying we support the 99% and start throwing the banksters in jail because the president has the bully pulpit. He could make that happen. Robert, Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Concerning In God We Trust, I kind of am a Christian, first of all, but it's kind of hypocritical. And if you can quote from the Bible, Matthew 25, you know, I feel like that should be emphasized. I haven't heard you say anything about about that yet. So,
if I may interrupt you, Robert, just to set the stage for those people who might have just tuned in, because I know you called in the, I believe you called in the previous hour. We talked about this in the previous hour. That Congress, the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republicans, instead of dealing with any part of President Obama's jobs bill, other than last week passing the free trade part, which I don't frankly think has anything to do with jobs, but other than paying for passing any part of the president's job bill, this week they're going to, in fact today, they're debating whether or not to make In God We Trust the national motto. And like, this is going to create jobs? No. And, you know, I agree with you. I think it's hypocritical. If we're going to have a national motto, if we're going to base it on something out of religion, you know, the whole Matthew 25 notion of, you know, as you do unto the least among you, you do unto me, you know, feed the hungry, house the homeless, heal the sick, give water to the thirsty, visit those in prison. I mean, you know, just the basic kind of, religious foundations, moral foundations. This goes way beyond religion. Moral foundations 101. We need to be doing that. Robert, thank you. Well, very well said. I appreciate the call. Daniel in Tennyson, Indiana. Hey, Daniel, what's up?
How you doing? I was hoping to kind of bring the issue back that they're trying to stuff this right-to-work law down our throats again here in Indiana.
You mean right-to-work for less?
You got it. Here in Indiana, most of the news media is controlled by Republicans so bad we can't ever get anything said anyway. An example here is October 27th in the Evansville Courier and Press. The big headline says the right to work will be back, and it says, just a brief here, it says, Republicans such as Representative Sue Elsperman, Republican from Ferdinand, argued, had to flip the page here, right-to-work measures would force unions to be more responsible to their members, and also wages have very little to do with whether or not you're union or not. I thought, yeah. That's actually a statement out of the Evansville Courier.
We're going to put you out of business and make you more responsive to your members. And by the way, being a member of a union has nothing to do with wages. That woman is living in la-la land. And, Daniel, thanks for the heads up on the misinformation and disinformation campaign going on in Indiana. I'll tell you, though, it is happening all over the country. Marie, is it Slagle, Louisiana?
It is Slagle, Louisiana.
Hey, Marie, what's on your mind?
First of all, I'd like to thank the 99% who are out there protesting for me. God bless them.
Amen.
Second thing I'd like to say is, how can we get Congress to go back to work? They've set their work schedule this next year to 109 days. Now, people really...
That's the House of Representatives.
I mean, the House of Representatives, excuse me.
The Republican House of Representatives.
Down to about 2 days a week.
Yeah.
Now, they're sitting back there and they want to raise Social Security for people who actually do a day's work to 70. And that's impossible for a construction worker to work till he's 70.
Yeah.
It's no wonder they can work till they're 100 years old in the Senate and the Congress, because they don't do any work. How can we get them to go back to work?
Elect Democrats. When Nancy Pelosi came in, and when Nancy came in and Pelosi came in and took control of the House of Representatives, she expanded
59 days.
She expanded the work week to 4 days. They actually have to have 1 day to fly back to their district on the assumption that on the weekends they're going to be in their district and they're going to be meeting with people. Now, many of them don't, but they should. And if your representative is not meeting with you, they need to be held to account. But that's, you know, that's a whole separate discussion. But the whole point is that when the Republicans come in, typically the Republicans go for a 3-day week or a 2-day week, and the Democrats typically go for a 4-day week in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Well,
for that 109
matter. Days is not going to get it.
Yeah.
Not at their salaries.
Yeah, there you go.
And our representative in this area, he told us right flat out, because we're Democrats, he's a Republican, he represents a business. And my husband asked him, well, I thought you was voted in by the people. And he said, oh, he said, I represent businesses. Well, then we found out he owns 6 Subways.
Oh.
No wonder.
So
what is his part-time job here? Is it being a representative or a Subway owner?
Well, if he owns them, he's a capitalist. He's not actually working in them. And, you know, so he's making money with money. And then as a legislator, he's probably making sure that people who are capitalists, who are making money with money,
vicious circle.
Are doing very, very well. Thank you very much. And that's this point that, you know, the members of Congress saw their wealth increase, net worth, over the last in the last year this would have been the last year, 25%, whereas the average American, you know, saw their net worth actually decline. But members of Congress, 25%. And 90% of that went to the top 50 wealthiest members of Congress. So Congress has its own 1% problem. Thank you very much for the call, Marie, and for your kind words. Daryl Issa, number two in Congress, by the way.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on, and also more of your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour. Kind of our problem right now. We don't have a draft, and so we don't have a strong enough anti-war movement. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Ready News Service, talkreadynews.com, brought to you by Ellen's birthday celebration, supplying help and resolving hunger for returning former slaves to the country of South Sudan. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen, welcome back to the program. What's up?
Well, thank you very much. The president today designated, now this may not seem like a big deal, Virginia's Fort Monroe. They had actually closed it. He designated it as a national monument. Now, everybody's saying, how come he's doing all this by executive order, et cetera? You know, I'm hearing on various right-wing networks, oh, he doesn't have the right to do it. Well, he sure does under the Antiquities Act. And what they're saying is that by doing this, by designating this a national monument, getting the Interior Department through the National Park Service involved, that it is actually not going to replace, as he says, the action that's needed by Congress, but it is going to help get Americans back to work. They expect 3,000 people to be back to work because of this. It was an outpost in 1819, but has a history as long as 1619 when it actually was a receiver area for slaves from Africa, speaking of slaves.
Wait a minute. So is the essence of what's going on here that by federalizing this property, the president is saying to a state government that refuses to hire people and refuses to put people back to work because it's controlled by Republicans, that and their whole campaign strategy is destroy the economy. By federalizing this, he can then use federal dollars to improve it or fix
yes,
it up.
Yes, now, again, I'm pretty sure that Fort Monroe was state. There may have been some federal designation in it, but not the kind of federal designation that we expect now, that it will be part of the Interior Department, most likely National Parks, because
right.
It is a national
which
monument.
Already has a
You're
budget
right.
for improving these kind of things.
Exactly. That's exactly where we're at on that
Amazing.
Kind of
So he's like building jobs little piece by little piece, because the House of Representatives this week, instead of voting on the jobs bill, is going to vote on whether or not In God We Trust should be the national motto.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually coming to a vote this afternoon. And it's coming to a vote this afternoon. Interestingly enough, it is one of two votes that's going to be taking place. Actually, there's three votes today that is going to be taking place. And that is what they're going to be voting on. Do
yeah.
you believe that?
Well, it's a totally political thing. If you're a Democrat and you vote to say no, In God We Trust shouldn't be our national motto, as by way of saying, you know, we've got more important things to do, and making something into the national motto is actually going to cost us all a lot of money, because you're going to have to, like, reprint things and change things and all that kind of stuff. And so it's, you know, it's already on our coins. What's the big deal? If you vote no, then in the next election, the Republican running against you is going to say, this guy voted against In God We Trust being our national motto, making you look like an atheist or an anti-American. And if you vote yes, because you're going to try and, you know, kind of pander to it, if you're a Democrat and you're saying, okay, I don't want that ad running in my district, then the Republicans get to say, hey, look at it, it's got bipartisan support. What's wrong with you over there in the Senate?
It's a Republican trick horse.
That's exactly right.
What it is, Tom.
It is a Trojan horse, yep.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, a few other interesting things. Of course, we've seen this chain issue come over and over and over again very, very quickly. And the question is whether there was a settlement. Was it an agreement? Was it a settlement? And
the what issue? Oh, Herman Cain.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
And what's amazing about this is that on the most recent poll that was done before this all came out yesterday, he was beating Perry in Texas.
Wow. You know, what's most amazing to me about this, Ellen, is that he's not actually running for president. This is a guy who has no staff or organization on the ground. His chief of staff, the guy smoking the cigarette in the ad, was the head of Americans for Prosperity in Wisconsin working for the Koch brothers, and so badly corrupted the political system in Wisconsin, he paid a $15,000 fine and was banned from engaging in any kind of political activity in that state for 3 years.
There's a question, Tom, as to whether a Wisconsin corporation started his campaign buying iPads, all that kind of thing, and whether that is going to somehow, whether that was an illegal campaign contribution, because they never expected it to get to this point.
No,
never.
What this is all about is, you know, from Herman Cain's point of view, this was all about doubling or tripling his speaker's fee, because he makes a living as a motivational speaker and selling his books.
And by the way, one publication referred to this as the silver lining in the cloud. $250,000 have been brought in since this came on yesterday.
So once he comes under attack, the Republicans who think that he is actually running for president start throwing money at him?
That's exactly right.
Amazing.
And listen, Tom, I have a deal. I'm going to split it with you. If you run for president next time around, I'll make a deal, and anything we get from contributions, things like that, your books, whatever, I'll split it with you.
Well, I could sell more books, and I could start charging a speaking fee. that's Newt Gingrich's strategy, too. You know, he's just trying to raise enough money that he can pay off his wife's Tiffany bill.
Exactly. Well, of course, and get some speaking engagements and get out there.
Right. This is his retirement plan, you know, is get a lot of visibility during the Republican primary. I'm not sure what the retirement plan is. I don't see how this plays in for Rick Santorum, unless it's try to get a gig on Fox News or something. But
Santorum just wants to get his numbers up there again so he can get some consulting and all that kind of stuff. By the way, speaking of numbers and things like that, they did announce the debate deal October 3rd, a little less than 11 months from now, in Denver, October 16th at Hofstra University on Long Island, October 22nd in Boca Raton at Lynn University.
Now, these are the actual debates between the Republican nominee and the Democrat,
right,
and President Obama.
That's right.
Oh, very interesting. Okay.
Couple other interesting things. The second minibus, that's the not a little minibus that goes around, but this is the actual bills that they are putting together, is going to come up tomorrow. They're going to be looking at Energy, Treasury, State Department, the FCC, GSA, Security and Exchange Commission, and among some other ones. And that is what they hope to get. Of course, the government turns into a pumpkin on November 18th.
Very, very interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Up next, a rumble. Ryan Streeter will be here. We're going to discuss tax reform, and then we'll be picking up your calls. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So why would anyone who is not, you know, earning over $300,000 a year or thereabouts be running around saying, let's cut taxes on rich people? I mean, after all, the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, when the top tax rates were between 91% and 74%, after you earned your first $1 million in today's dollars, were the four periods of growth that were the greatest periods of expansion of GDP in the history of the United States, because rich people had an incentive to keep their money in their business rather than take it out and gamble with it. Whenever we've seen taxes on those rich people go below 50%, what we see are bubbles. Witness what happened from 1920 when Harding came into office and dropped the top tax rate from 90% down to 25%. Between 1920 and 1929, when that bubble blew up. Why would anybody propose that? Ryan Streeter with Conservative Home USA, the editor of Conservative Home USA, conhomeusa.com, the website, is with us. Ryan, I don't get it.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back.
Thank you. And good to have you with us. I think I just laid out my argument. I need not shout over
right.
you or anything.
So the there are a lot of factors, I think, that explain the kind of GDP growth that you're talking about. I think what you also have to account for is a lot of growth that happened after what I know you don't like to talk about, because I think we've discussed this before on your program. But when the marginal tax rates came down under Reagan, we did actually see a good period of growth and investment after that. And I think what we're talking about is the difference between gambling with money, which is the way you characterized it, which does happen. Indeed, it happens. But you also have a lot more investment going on.
And, so Ryan, what you're suggesting...
You need investments in order to have new enterprises starting, and I think that's what we need right now.
So, you know, prior to Reagan, we had... You know, we had growth and we had investment, and the 80s did not grow as fast as the 70s, 60s, 50s, or 40s, and neither did the 90s, and certainly the last decade has been a disaster, you know, the kind of culmination of this. But what Reagan did during those 8 years, and when you add George, the first 2 years of George Bush to make the entire decade of the 80s, what they did was they ran up a $4.5 trillion debt. And spent that money, and that is highly stimulative. I mean, Obama spent, you know, $800 billion, arguably $500 billion. The rest of it was tax cuts. And, you know, it created 3 million jobs. Created 3 million jobs or helped prevent, you know, the hemorrhaging. So if you borrow money and spend it, as the federal government, it will create jobs. I mean, nobody's disputing that. Even the people who say, you know, the New Deal didn't get us out of the Great Depression. World War II did. Are simply saying if your government spending is massive enough, World War II was, you know, five times the spending or whatever it was of the New Deal. If your government spending is massive enough, it'll get you out of a depression. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that the way that we should have our economy is we should borrow literally 100%, 200%. Well, during the course of the Reagan presidency, 300% of previous debt. We should borrow 300% of previous debt, spend that into the economy to stimulate the economy. And that's basically been the Republican plan ever since 1980. And, you know, you're right. It will grow the economy. Problem is you end up with this enormous debt. I don't understand why you would be in favor of that rather than the system that worked so well in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s and the first 2 years of the 80s. Or for that matter, the last 3 years of the Clinton administration that not only left us with no debt, but also left us with growth and a budget surplus.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of massive debt. I mean, our debt to GDP ratios now are tremendously deleterious on the economy. So the question that we all have to just be asking is what drives growth? And, you know, the latest stimulus was historically huge. And unemployment did not go below the 8% that Barack Obama said that it would. I mean,
it went below 14%, which is the direction that there was a consensus it was heading for.
Well, I don't know if it was a consensus. So some people believe that.
According to the Fed, according to the Congressional Budget Office, I mean, you know, there were some people like Paul Krugman who were predicting 16%. In fact, if you look at if you calculate unemployment the exact same way that we did during the Great Depression, we are at 16% unemployment right now.
Well, I guess this is the question, Tom. I mean, we will not grow this economy if we do not see more new high growth enterprises starting. I mean, that's where all the job growth of the last 30 years has come from. Big corporations create a big goose egg. They create zero net new jobs every decade.
Well, actually, big corporations have been exporting our jobs. They've created 240,000 jobs, and they've exported 290,000 jobs. No,
right.
2.4
okay.
million
so
versus
the,
2.9
the growth,
million.
The growth comes from new enterprises, and not just new ones, but
small businesses.
Yeah, companies that are between 3 and 7 years old. That's where the growth comes from in this country. And
sure.
So you got to be asking the question, what types of policies actually drive that? Does stimulative spending drive it? Some. I mean, there's certainly,
I would say the Sherman Antitrust Act drives that.
You're not gonna see stimulus spending though create the kind of long term trajectory of growth that I think we really need. And so the question
I agree, and it didn't during Reagan.
What do we do? Well, we did see a period of growth. I think that tailed into the 90s. Obviously, Clinton was president during that time, and it was a good presidency by those measures. I'm not disagreeing with that. But I think there's also a pretty wide consensus that the changes in tax policies in the 80s did lead to that kind of growth. A growth.
Of course, because Reagan borrowed $3 trillion. You give me a $3 trillion credit card, I can show you what it looks like to live large and have everyone around me look incredibly prosperous. But I'm going to leave behind a $3 trillion debt that my children, in this case you, are going to have to pay off. That's what Reagan did to you. And you're looking back at it saying this was some kind of wonderful time. It wasn't a wonderful time. Reagan took an economy that was relatively anemic, borrowed $3 trillion, spent it, stimulated in a way that no Democrat had way beyond Keynes, and demonstrated Keynesian economics. And then George Bush, you know, was looking at the deficit going, holy cow, it's going to hit $5 trillion on my watch. I can't do that. And he had to raise taxes to prevent that from happening, which cost him the election. But it's like, I don't get it. Republicans are talking out of two sides of their mouths. It's like you want to borrow like crazy to stimulate the economy, and then you say, but don't stimulate the economy. You acknowledge that large corporations are job killers, yet when Reagan stopped the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982, when he stopped the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and no president has had the cojones to reinforce that since then. The last two presidents to do it were Jerry Ford and Jimmy Carter, who both agreed it was time to break up AT&T, which, by the way, increased shareholder value for people who owned AT&T stock when it was broken up into all those companies. The Sherman Act provides a space for small companies. Now we've got monopolies. You know, when Reagan came into office, you could walk into any mall or downtown in America, and every store was locally owned in a small business, and that drove the American economy. That's no longer the case. We have an oligarchy economy.
Marginal tax rates came down from 70% to 28% under Reagan, right? And
yeah.
So the stimulative spending was not all the borrowing that you're talking about. There was a lot of new investment flowing to enterprises, and you did see, look, you and I have talked about this before. We agree that large monopolies are a big problem. My point here is when you see that kind of change in tax policy, you see a lot of new investment flowing to small enterprises and to new companies. And that's, we can't get that same kind of growth now.
Brian, we didn't.
As a conservative, I'll say that.
What we saw was agglomeration. What we saw was consolidation. And we've been seeing it for 30 years, ever since Reagan did that. The big have been getting bigger. The small are getting wiped out.
Yeah, and prices have come down for middle-income families, too, as a part of that.
For things manufactured in China.
Yeah, but the point being here, look, Mike, the question that I just want to keep coming back to is, say, what will create growth of new enterprises? And quite frankly, the stimulus spending we've seen from this administration and the most recent so-called jobs bill, which is kind of like stimulus 2.0, doesn't get us to the level of growth that we need. I don't see
I agree. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts and start enforcing the Sherman Act.
I think what we need is more investment flowing to enterprises and get rid of the uncertainty that keeps people from starting new enterprises.
Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sorry about that, Ryan. Ryan Streeter, conhomeusa.com. Ryan, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom. Okay.
Good talking. I find it just absolutely amazing. It's like history is being rewritten. I had a guy on our TV show last night on Free Speech TV and RT who was debating me about tax policies, and it was not dissimilar from the conversation I just had with Ryan. And I was like, roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and he's like, you mean so that after somebody makes $1 million, they start paying 74% income tax? And I'm like, yeah, you know, do that. And he's like, but then people will stop working. And I'm like, dude, you've been reading too many Ayn Rand novels. You know, in the real world, what happened back in the day, and this is kind of the tragedy. There's this whole generation of 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and even probably 40-year-olds who have no recollection of what it was like when the average CEO made 30 times. I mean, literally the CEO of General Electric or the CEO of General Motors made 30 times what the janitors made. Because if you made more than that, the government took it in taxes. And so they lived a upper middle class life. They lived a petty bourgeois life, you know, kind of the small rich, but not you know, they weren't kingdoms. They weren't making hundreds of millions of dollars like these health, you know, like Stephen Hemsley with the United Healthcare. It's just the simple answer is people will still, you know, if they enjoy their work and they're good at it, they'll work for $1 million a year and stop at that point. The logic or the lack of logic or the lack of understanding of history just blows my mind. I don't know how to put it beyond that. Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been walking the sidewalk here at the Occupy Albuquerque site, the now defunct Occupy Albuquerque site, since last Wednesday. And I've been just trying to think about some of the things we can do, seeing that the elections are coming up next year, and this could be a really big boon for us and for our movement. And I thought about Grover Norquist and his boys, and I thought, right, you know what? You know what this site needs? Are people to sign our own pledge. We need to create our own pledge. People who will say, I will not outsource a single job. I will reinstitute Glass-Steagall. I will do my best to uphold the Sherman antitrust laws. All the things that have gotten us into this mess since Reagan.
Yeah.
We need people who will absolutely promise and hold themselves accountable by virtue of a pledge to do those things once they get into office. We need to get rid of the blue dogs. We need to expose them for what they really are, which is Republicans and the obstructionists that they are to their own party. We need to oust them. And I think really all these new people who are going to be running for office need to have something from this movement to grab a hold of. I think that we could really provide them with a lot of material.
Yeah.
And so I just thought of, I don't know, what you know, and I'm coming because I really respect your opinion, and I'd like to hear what you think about a pledge like that.
I think that the pledge that an elected member of Congress takes is a pledge to uphold the Constitution and to serve their constituents, and it really should be limited at that. I think that anybody who signs Grover Norquist's pledge is putting a lobbyist who was on the edge of some major felonies with Jack Abramoff, that being Grover Norquist, is putting him above their constituents. And that should be an indictment of that politician, that they're willing to put, you know, a corrupt lobbyist ahead of their own constituents, frankly. And if you're looking at those policies, the problem with that pledge is it's not super simple like Norquist's is, I won't raise taxes. And so if you're looking at something that's quite simple, simply look at the Progressive Caucus. The Progressive Caucus is the largest or maybe the second largest caucus in the United States Congress. It was created by Bernie Sanders and I believe Dennis Kucinich back in the day. And it's done some really, really great work. It has some really great members. One of my favorites, Jan Schakowsky, for example, Nancy Pelosi, Dennis Kucinich, Bernie Sanders, some great people who, you know, Sherrod Brown, who really care. And their pledge is to their people. Their pledge is to the people in the district.
But didn't a lot of those people also just vote in favor of the part of the Jobs Act that dealt with these free trade agreements, these job-killing free trade agreements?
The free trade agreement was defeated by Democrats 2-1. But the one-third of Democrats who voted for it, which is your blue dogs, voted with 100% of the Republicans to pass it in the House of Representatives. But virtually to a person, the Progressive Caucus voted against that piece of legislation.
There's that many blue dogs, Tom? I mean, that's...
Yeah, there's all... You know, when the Republicans control the House of Representatives, you don't even need one. Because it's majority rule. There's no filibuster in the House of Representatives. But, yeah, you had I don't know, I don't recall the numbers now. We had them the day that it happened. But there was some...
But it only took two, right? It only took Ben Nelson and that other guy in the Senate this last time.
Yeah.
To kill in the Senate what could have been a real big...
Yeah, the other guy was Joe Lieberman. Yeah. Yeah, and well, actually, you know, in the Senate they got 50 votes. I mean, they, you know, and this isn't for the trade bill. This was for the last piece of progressive legislation, and they got 50 votes. But they, you know, the Mitch McConnell is saying you got to have 60 votes for everything. Something that in the entire, you know, 230 plus year history of the Senate has never been done before. And
I think maybe the one third of Democrats that voted along with the Republicans on those free trade agreements, which which really we need to focus on, because outsourcing is one of the big, it's just really probably the major problem to our economy. They need to be exposed. I don't know where to look for a list of their names. Maybe.
Well, start with your own member of Congress. And this is what, you know, if everybody listening to me did this right now, called your own member of Congress and said, you know, did you vote for these free trade deals? Because if so, I'm not going to vote for you, or I'm going to be very ambivalent about voting for you. Or, you know, I don't think any of us, frankly, should be single issue voters, particularly in an election where the most important vote a person makes is for the speaker. I mean, if we ended up with a Democratic majority and they elected Speaker Pelosi back, I'd be very happy, even if they'd voted for the trade deal. But, Mike,
you're
good point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, more of your thoughts and mine, and the good, the bad, and the fill-in vocabulary word, ugly. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very muckmiddenly ugly. The good, Andy Douglas. With 1 week to go until Ohio voters determine the fate of the radical anti-union bill SB5, former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Andy Douglas is weighing in on the matter, saying that SB5 returns Ohio back to the dark days before collective bargaining. Douglas went on to say, "I'm a Republican, and I've been working side by side with independents and Democrats to see that this bad bill does not become law. Senate Bill 5 must be rejected." According to early polls, it looks like Senate Bill 5 will be rejected. Let's hope anti-union Republicans get the message that working people are fed up with having their rights taken away from them by the top 1%. The bad, Condoleezza Rice. We can add the former Secretary of State to the list of Bush officials who are trying to rewrite history and claim credit for President Obama's foreign policy accomplishments. In an interview with USA Today, Rice said, referring to the Arab Spring, "The change in the conversation about the Middle East, where people now routinely talk about democratization, is something that I'm very grateful for, and I think we, as in the Bush administration, had a role in that." Actually, the Bush administration played a role in starting two brutal and long-lasting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, two places in the Middle East where people are still killing each other and not trying to build their own democracy. President Obama proved, when he went to Cairo and gave his "Tear Down These Dictators" speech, that foreign policy objectives are best achieved without military invasion. So if there's one thing we can thank the Bush and Condoleezza Rice administration for, it's for showing us what not to do in the Middle East. And the very, very ugly, the Loudoun County Republican Party. For some reason, these Virginia Republicans figured it'd be a good idea to get in the Halloween spirit by sending out a mailer yesterday depicting President Obama as a zombie, complete with part of his skull missing and a bullet hole right through his head. That's right, the President of the United States shot through the head on a Republican Party official mailer. Virtually every single Republican has condemned the Loudoun County mailer, with the Republican Party of Virginia calling it a disgusting image. When you've gone so low that even the rest of the Republican Party agrees it's disgusting, then you know you've done something very, very ugly. And that's our good, the bad, and the very, very ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. Ann in Detroit. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program. What's up?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
I do, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm calling because, you know, the conversation with this one guy you had on there, he was talking about growing the economy. You know, some people don't want to grow this defunct, antiquated economy. They're done with it, you know. And some people, you know, and the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party is a bourgeois party, no matter how you want to wear it. I mean, it's bourgeois all the way.
Any political party in power is a bourgeois party by definition.
Yeah, Democrats, I mean, they're so spineless. They're always trying to move to the right, trying to cozy up with the right with the...
Yeah, but and look at the Green Party in Germany, where they actually have power. They've become a bourgeois party. I mean, that's what happens. The party in power becomes basically the party of the middle class and the upper middle class. And
another thing I want to say, too, is that, you know, this saying, "In God we trust." I mean, you know, it's all right to be an atheist. In fact, a lot of people are atheists who are very ethical and much more ethical than a lot of religious people. Really,
I don't disagree with you at all. I absolutely, Anne, I don't disagree with you at all, and I'm not going to debate atheism. And you're right. It is a total waste of time for Congress to be passing a resolution that says "In God We Trust" as our national slogan or whatever. But that's what Congress is doing today. Josh in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I caught you on Bill Maher a couple weeks ago. Nice job.
Thank you.
You were really well-behaved.
I was doing my best.
Yeah, I thought so. I was expecting you to, like, every so often I'd just yell at the screen, you know, kick him the butt, Tom, but the moment never really happened. I was hoping it was there, but hopefully you get invited back. So
one of these days.
Hopefully. So I want to talk about a couple of things, really. There's a video from Peter Schiff going around. He's, I guess, the second in command for Ron Paul's campaign.
Yeah.
And he's asking people at the Occupy Wall Street a bunch of questions just to kind of see what their answers are and that sort of thing. It's got a lot of interesting ideas in it, too. But one of the things he says, kind of like Bill O'Reilly, is that if you increase my taxes a certain amount, I'm going to stop working.
Right.
And, you know, why would you work for 30 cents in the dollar and that kind of thing? And it just got me to thinking, like, well, isn't that the whole idea behind competition? Like, if this guy were to stop working, or if all these rich Andrandian folks were to stop working, wouldn't 10 jobs or, like, 10 companies spring up to take their place?
Yes.
Which is so good. Like, I mean, you've said this before, right? Like, if you're going to leave, fine, go. We don't need you and your crony capitalism. You just, you know,
there you go.
We'll replace
there's
you
lot,
with something better.
There's so lots of other people who would love to take that job. You're absolutely right. Well said, Josh. Thank you. That's such a brilliant point, and it needs to be made over and over and over again. Mark in Orlando. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm with Occupy Orlando, and I've been on the ground there for the past 18 days in sidewalk solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
We represent the 99%, and I appreciate you, you know, giving it the airtime you do. We've been getting active. We've been at every public meeting that we can go to, from city and county councils to labor negotiations with the ATU at the Lynx Transit here in Orlando that they're trying to privatize. We've been to the mayor yesterday. We talked to him about they give our Chamber of Commerce a lease for 30 years. At a dollar a year. So the place where we're residing right now is at Senator Beth Johnson Park.
Mm-hmm.
And at the park, we're right next to the Chamber of Commerce, and they get that building for a dollar a year.
That's
and
incredible.
They don't pay any taxes.
How'd they do that kind of a sweet deal?
Well, it happened like back in we have a gentleman who researched it, and he actually pulled up the paperwork, and it happened like in the 1969, and right. The deal's been just continued. And
incredible.
At the end of this next lease, they get to return the building for, like, nothing. So we're saying, give us the same lease. We'll even double it, and then after 30 years, they can have our tent. You know, so we just want to – they're not changing. The mayor was very stubborn, and we had actually, like, 25 people. I mean, this thing, take it active, you're it, is really important.
Yeah.
And Occupy Orlando has effectively went and been a presence to support organized labor and to really speak truth to power. Some of the meetings we can't really talk, but we've seen the greed of corporations maneuver and try to, you know, really prohibit the employees. And just really, it's a really a terrible oppression right now going on. And in these meetings, the things discussed, now, we're freaking them out because we're sitting there, and now we're witnesses to what's going on in these meetings and the favoritism and stuff that's going on. Like, they took all the lobbyists first in yesterday's council meeting, and then they waited, and then they all got to leave. But then we stayed, and we extended that meeting with about an hour and a half of five-minute speeches that we had prepared. And we just asked the mayor for our First Amendment right because we feel that that overrides some city ordinance
that
we can't practice our free speech rights, and we want to redress our grievances, man.
There you go.
And they're not listening to us, brother.
Well, actually, they are, Mark. They may be pretending not to. You know, it's the old Gandhi saying: first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. And you know, it's just stay with the program, stay nonviolent, and let me salute you for your patriotism, Mark. It is important work you're doing, and thanks for the update from Orlando, from Occupy Orlando, Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today? It's good. It really is good to see you, Tom.
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
Oh, all right, great. You know, I got a statement to make earlier about the homeless and the squatters and the police occupying the position, placing these people in the schizophrenics in there. Well, I got a comment, and it doesn't matter who is Democratic or who's Republican. It really doesn't matter, because some people are going to accept what they say anyway, and they're going to do the bidding of the corporate greed anyhow.
Sure.
So there's a lot of corruption in the system, and it's like a cancer, you said, and it should be removed. The General Assembly of the occupation should show that they can manage the people well, that by using social sources to do what they are existing for. The General Assembly and the occupation should lead and set up something.
Well, I think what they're doing, I mean, their mandate is not to run a homeless shelter, but what they're doing is they're reaching out to the local homeless shelters, they're reaching out to the local food resources, they're reaching out to the local social services, and so when the police or anybody sends a homeless person down or a schizophrenic down or somebody who is not there for the politics but is there for a free meal, they will, you know, in many of these cities, the people are being assigned the job of trying to get those people the social services they need so that the Occupy folks can get back to the work of the Occupy. Sharon, and thanks for the call. Sharon in Belleville, Michigan. Sharon, we have just a minute to the break. A quick one, I hope.
Well, I hope so, too. I remember in September 10th, right before the 9/11, 2001, mm-hmm. that Rumsfeld had made an announcement that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon. And then last week you mentioned that a commission in Congress, the Wartime Contracting Commission, has discovered $60 billion taken now, and that they've decided to classify that report.
Yes,
my question
for 20
is,
years.
Do you know if anything happened with the $2.3 trillion? Did they find any of that?
The $2.3 trillion is still missing.
And who was on the commission, this wartime contracting, who voted to classify this, keep this from the American people?
That's a good question, and I should have come up with that list and read it on the air. I didn't. I don't have that information in front of me, so I can't share that with you. But, Sharon, my guess would be that if you use a search engine, you could find it very quickly. And probably somebody in our chat room has that information. If you want to drop by TomHartmann.com and just drop into the chat room, I'm guessing they will put it up pretty quickly. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, the Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movement is actually having an effect. The banks are backing off on their $5 fees, step by step.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Caitlin Saposi-Belknap and Scott Silber are on the line with us. Caitlin and Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here again.
Thank you
for having us.
Yeah, very pleased to have you with us. Scott, you're with Boulder Move to Amend. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
So tell us what's happening in Boulder today.
Well, today's the last day of our weeks-long mail-in ballot election, and the polls close at 7 p.m. And we're pretty excited in Boulder to be the second city in the United States to be able to vote on whether we support an amendment to the U.S. Constitution asserting that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech.
God bless you. that is absolutely spectacular. And, Caitlin, you're the National Field Director for MoveToAmend.org. And, you know, I'm pitching MoveToAmend.org constantly. I don't know if you've seen all the YouTubes of all the...
We really appreciate it.
It's like become my you think I own stock in your organization or something. I mean, I really have nothing to do with the organization other than just I think you people are my heroes. But tell us, what is the national organization doing? What are you up to right now?
Well, Move to Amend is the national campaign to pass the constitutional amendment to abolish corporate personhood and establish that money is not speech, as Scott said. And so our strategy, because, you know, we all know that in Congress, if we're talking about a constitutional amendment, we're talking about ultimately Congress. But Congress is bought and sold by corporations. So we have a grassroots strategy and plan to get this amendment passed by working in local communities, and we have communities all over the country that are working with us to pass resolutions just like the one that they're going to pass today in Boulder, to call for the amendment to drive this into Washington, D.C. from the ground up.
So today is the vote in Boulder, and it's a mail-in vote. Today is the last day, 7 o'clock tonight. You got to get your ballots to the post office. before 7, if I have that right. Correct me if I'm wrong, Scott.
I will correct you. Actually, it's too late to mail them in. They're due to the clerk and recorder's office.
Okay, thank you for correcting. Okay, so you have to physically get them in.
That's right.
How's it looking? And Scott Silver with Boulder Move to Amend. How's it looking, A, and B, what did y'all do to make this happen in Boulder that our listeners and viewers all around the country need to be thinking about doing in their own communities?
It's looking great. I think people in our community are really excited for the opportunity to finally be able to express themselves on this issue. And thanks to the folks in Madison who passed their language first, language that we have referred to here in Colorado as the Madison language, we were able to follow suit. They voted in an election in April, and we had the opportunity to have our city council here in Boulder take the issue on, and some of the folks with Boulder Move to Amend had gotten the ear of an interest of some of the folks on city council who then moved the issue forward, and there was actually a majority of dissenters on the Boulder City Council at first. It was out of 9 people, it was 3 in support and 6 against. So we had to do our local organizing campaign here in town to work with and eventually win over a majority, and we flipped that from 3-6 to 6-3 and
Wow.
got the question on the ballot, the Madison language, as it was in Madison, on the Boulder ballot for our 2011 ballot, and the campaign since then has been an enormous effort from a coalition of a list of organizations that's too broad and wide to,
right.
to read.
Well, and the really cool bottom line about this is that whether you win or lose the election, you educated a hell of a lot of people. And although, you know, people in Boulder, get out and vote today, physically show up and vote. Caitlin, I understand that voters in Missoula, Montana will vote on a similar initiative next week. We are heard and seen in Missoula, Montana. Tell us about that.
It'll be on the ballot next week in Missoula, and so folks are already voting absentee, and the election is on Tuesday, like it is really across the country. And we worked with city council members in Missoula to get that on the ballot as well, and so Missoula Move to Amend is running that. And if folks are interested in running campaigns in your communities, you can go to movetoamend.org and click on the start or find a local group or our local action toolkit. We have model language for the resolution, details about how it's done. And we expect it to win in Boulder and in Missoula. In Madison, in April, the vote there was 82% in favor of the initiative.
Wow.
And in Dane County, it was also on the ballot.
Now, just
slightly
to,
different wording, and they passed it by 78%.
And just to provide some context, and again, please correct me if I have anything wrong about this, but basically, no legislature and no president has ever said corporations are people and money is speech. This is purely an invention of the Supreme Court. It goes back to the early part of the 19th century, arguably, but it hit its zenith with the Citizens United ruling in January of 2010. And this doctrine has totally corrupted American politics. And because the Supreme Court has embraced it and promoted it, the only way right now that we can, you know, the only practical way that we can undo this is by amending the Constitution of the United States to say, no, in fact, corporations are not people and money is not speech. Is that a reasonably tight and articulate articulation of it?
You're exactly right. That's why we love you. You're a perfect spokesperson.
Okay.
You totally have it.
Thank you.
And it's time that we as a country have a debate and discussion about this, because you're right. It came from the Supreme Court. It wasn't ever legislated on. And in fact, when communities have had the opportunity to say, well, what would we want in our democracy? The answer is resoundingly not corporate personhood. People
right.
should have rights, not corporations.
Well, and in fact, President Teddy Roosevelt pushed back on this. Congress pushed back on it in 1907, passing the Tillman Act that
mm-hmm.
said any corporation that gives money to a politician, their officers go to prison. And, you know, that got blown up by Citizens United, among other things. But anyhow, okay, so if you're
involved, we want to let folks know what the ballot measure is. It's
yes, sir.
2H. And if you got your ballot finally and you haven't sent it in or you haven't walked it in yet to 33rd in Arapahoe, the ballot measure is 2H. That's what we want you to vote yes on. And everyone here at the 2H campaign wants to remind you, Tom Hartman, of the role of hero you played for us and making sure that we were educated enough to do that.
Thank you, Scott. We're flat out. Scott and Caitlin, thank you both so much for being with us. It is truly appreciated. Coming up tomorrow, what's really holding up hiring in America, regulations of Republicans, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're at Occupy Something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.